way, and its rods. We're going to use that. And there's wristbands of two varieties of colors. Which you're going to be handed out. Okay, let me, in this way, explain this as I'm meditating on the scope of the subject matter, and being that it's the first time that I've taught the Yoga Sutras. I used to have a Wednesday class online where I went through it. But it didn't have that time constraint. Whatever I finished, I finished. So I'm kind of keeping my eye on the ball that there's a whole subject matter to cover. Because I can see some of these things, you can go into such depth, but at the same time, we want to kind of cover a certain amount. So, here's the mind, right? Maybe we'll start like this. Here's the soul. And basically, this connection, somehow, we don't want to talk about origins. There's so many philosophical points. It causes, basically, okay, first, so the mind is very, very malleable. We have that. And according to our what comes to us in our destiny and the actions we make, and the environment we keep, the mind will take a particular shape, and according to that shape or form, you'll have a particular mental state. And it's not just one, there's shades of them. Okay? And these strands of matter, which are called ignorance, passion, and goodness, they allow you to conduct various activities. This allows you to conduct enlightenment and understanding. This allows you to conduct intense activity. This allows you to sleep, give inertia. So it's kind of like that. So the environment, I'll just explain basically, you know, the environment. There's a whole lecture I give. I'm not going to give that now, but the environment is made in the same thing as the mind is. This is just more subtle. So, for example, the environment is the objects of your senses, the objects of sight, the objects of sound, the object of smell, the objects of touch. I left out one.
He's curious.
Object of sound. Yeah, what is it?
Tasting.
What?
Tasting.
Tasting, yes. They're also in the modes. So if you have an environment in a particular way, it will influence the mind to become in that way. And if you have a mind in that way, it will influence the environment. Just, let's say, in terms of practical things, cleanliness is the object of sight in goodness, right? Clutter probably is getting to the object of sight and passion. Maybe like filth will be the object of passion and ignorance or something like that. But, okay, here's the environment. If it's very clean, it's going to morph the mind towards goodness. Right? If you want to write and you want to study, for example, the mind has to be very clear. You have to get the mind to a condition of clarity. Right? I mean, let's say that you just ate a huge meal and then you conked out catatonic. And you had one of those sleeps that, you know, it just never rested. And then you get up, and then you begin your studies. Your mind is like this right now. You'll be reading the first paragraph of the Yoga Sutras over and over again. It's just not clear. On the other hand, if you woke up early in the morning, you didn't eat too much the night before, you get up, go to the bathroom, take a shower, cleanliness, associating with the morning hours, which are in the mode of goodness, then you'll read, you'll be 10 times more effective. I had this exact experience in studying the Yoga Sutras. In fact, I had to study some sections to understand that I won't teach them, because they took me so much time to understand. I've been doing this for 40 years. But to try to understand them, to be able to teach something, you really have to understand it clearly. You know, I saw that when I studied, you know, in the morning, you know, and rested, but not, you know, so much more clarity. What to speak of meditation, and what to speak of yoga, and things like that. What to speak of your basic quality of your life. Same thing with sounds. Same thing with sounds. There's music in the mode of ignorance. Music in the mode of passion. Why in war do they have drums and trumpets and things like that? Because they want people's minds like this. Boom, 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 boom. Charge. Right? It moves the mind in that way. Even the classic example I tell, in that the when they realized that, you know, people couldn't drive, everybody couldn't drive into New York anymore, there was too much traffic, they had to encourage public transportation. When I grew up, people did not take the buses in from Jersey. Why? Because the Port Authority was such a dump. And it was filled with the, we called it at the time, the bums. But that was nothing bad, because that was the name of the baseball team in Brooklyn. But we called it the bums. They were bums, right? So people didn't want to go, and they needed to get out the bums to get the people, the middle class people, to come by the buses. So they called the police. They dragged them out. They went back in. They dragged them out. They went back in. Finally, someone thought, oh, why don't we try playing some classical music? So when your mind is like this, in ignorance, and you don't, you know, you're attracted to actually not doing anything and keeping things cluttered, and, you know, then you like actually the environment that way. You want to enjoy inertia, even though it's suffering. That's another factor. We like to enjoy so many things that are suffering. So what happens is we want environment like that, and we like environment like that. That's why we're here in New York. We like passion, right? Therefore, we want that environment. It's somehow or other. Whether it's the thing that makes us happy or not, that's another thing. But we're attracted to so many things. So what happened is they played classical music. Dun, 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 dun. And they left. They didn't want an environment like that. Right? Because it moves your mind to act, you know, it moves you to a higher kind of mode. So it's like that. There's so many examples. So the environment, that's why food is so important in spiritual life too. Because what you eat is also in different modes. And therefore, yogis would eat in a particular sattvic way. I'm making this very, very simple. So that's the environment. And then the actions that you do, right? If you do the correct action, and a lot, you even see, we're going to get to the yamas and the niyamas about behavior and what's proper. If in a particular circumstance and in your lifestyle, there's a myriad of choices that you have to make, what is the right one? Well, that's what the teachings are for. Not only the teachings, that's what the mentors are for, because sometimes it takes finesse to apply the particular principle to yourself. Some things like nonviolence, in one sense, are for everyone or something, but other choices. So the proper choice is called Dharma. And if you understand the appropriate response to your particular circumstance, it will be the response that morphs the mind to a higher level of perception. And then there's spiritual practice, which is called sometimes sadhana. Sadhana, we practice. And in the traditional meditational thing, you actually spend some part of the day just working on the mind by controlling it and disciplining it and all these other good thoughts. And basically what happens is good thoughts, they mold the mind to sattva, and they're in sattva, they're in goodness. And the passionate thoughts and the ignorant thoughts, which we know what they are, they kind of morph the mind to a lower degree. So this is basically how yoga works. You have to understand that sattva. Everything's trying to do to make the mind more peaceful to a higher level of perception. So it's not just the practice. I went started from a lifestyle. It's a lifestyle. And when you discuss the yams and the niyams, the yams and the niyams are the lifestyle. The first two things is how you deal with others and how you deal with yourself. Yams mean how you control the mind. You first have to control the mind by how you relate to others. That's the yams. And the niyams is how you control the mind in relationship to yourself. Then for that yogi, there is the asana. In fact, I heard a scholar say it's anga. In this regard, there's eight different Ashtanga yoga. Anga doesn't mean like only limbs, it more means parts, in the sense that yoga is the whole thing. It's not like, it's true they're progressive, but it's not like you go on to niyams and then you give up the yamas. And then you go to asana and you give up that. You go to the asana, it's all together. Now here's the interesting things, and it describes therefore this mind, because it wants to be able to identify what are the obstacles and what are the thoughts that you have to control and cease. So then what it has is something called klesha. Klesha means that somehow or other, when this unification is made, or this identification is made, sometimes it's described something like, a nice example is a child wants the moon. He can't attain the moon, but the mother, to please him, gives him a pot of water that reflects the moon. The child can't hold the water, and it begins to shake, and then the child becomes fearful that the moon is moving. So it's something like that. When you don't want to be what you are, which is a pure awareness, a soul, in my tradition, a loving soul, the consciousness receives. This is bhakti, I can throw that in, just as I identify it. Bhakti means, what is the perfection of consciousness? It's love. The symptom of the nature of the soul is consciousness, which reaches perfection in love. But anyway, when somehow or other we want this conception of control, ego, self-centeredness, whatever it is, somehow or other the consciousness is reflected on the body. So it describes the kleshas. The kleshas are the principles of trouble or obstacle. The first one is called avidya, it's ignorance. And what is ignorance is when this, the pure thing, identifies with that. Then from that comes what's called asmita. It's kind of the ignorance takes on a form, whether in terms of the body and the mind, an identification with a particular species of life, a particular gender, a particular nationality, a particular family. And then from that becomes attachment. We have selfish desires. And then we have aversions. We don't like many things that are good for us. And then the last one, we'll explain that later, is called clinging for life. But here. And from this conception arises, the reason why it's going to be described, arises these vrittis, these thoughts. Good thoughts and bad thoughts. But the basic thing is, everything born from ignorance, it's morphing the mind into a lower state of perception. And then it's going to describe later on, I should mention, some of the thoughts are good and some of the thoughts are bad. Thoughts that are good are called a klishta. They don't cause trouble. You have thoughts for, well, hopefully it comes from this class, you know, a little higher sense of morality, controlling yourself for the best things, the good things. Otherwise, why are you here? You want to get some knowledge. So you have some discrimination, some wisdom, some control. And then the bad thoughts, the selfishness and greed and all these things. So what happens is basically with the mind. What happens with the mind is, due to those thoughts, you become attracted to certain things, and you become attached to certain things. So now I'm going to make the demonstration of it here, okay? First, they have to clean the mind. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna. That's not part of it. That was a joke. But don't worry. Okay. So, okay, you see this? This is going to be the mind, and this is going to be the intelligence. This is not the mind. This is going to be the manas. This is what categorizes things and has feelings towards them. So this is basically, it's very practical. This is how it works. And these are going to be, I'll show you how it works. Okay? I'll show you on the basis, we'll just concentrate on how addiction works. Okay? It's really interesting. And then we're going to do a little exercise. Okay? Okay, now, when you're young, right, you know, you grow in a culture, and the culture's a particular way, and it's a drinking culture. So when you're 13 or something, your father takes you and says, here, son, have a beer, right? Now you have the impression, this must be good, because my father's giving it, and all these cool people that I see, they're doing it, so you take a drink. Right? So literally what happens is you enjoy it, right? And it leaves an impression in the consciousness. Okay, now it's left an impression in the consciousness. Now what happens is that's who you are now. You're composed of your attachments and aversions. Now what can happen is, now, you can be attracted to something that causes you trouble. That's called klishta. Now, you're attached to drinking, and it gives you a kind of a pleasure, but there's some types of attachments or pleasures that, in terms of yoga or something, even though they give you momentary pleasure, they'll actually morph the mind to a lower degree of perception and contentment. In other words, you may get a sensual stimulation that's happy, but it won't be good to your mind. Right? So let's say, okay, so you take a You're drinking. So, okay, now you have this attachment. And what happens is, now that's different from a vritti. That's called the samskara. It's an impression, an attachment. It will lead to thought, but you're not always thinking of it. Right? But what will happen is, when you come in contact with it, or you're at a party or something like that, then you'll want to fill that with the same thing that caused it. But what happens is, and this was so revelatory to understand it, what happens is you do it again, it will create another impression. Right? So now the desire for it is stronger. Right? So now, again, and let's say another impression, it becomes stronger. Right? And if you have enough of these, it becomes called a vasana, or a habit. It kind of becomes part of your nature. Now what happens is very interesting. Now, if there's so many of them, right, somehow or other, then what happens is, when it comes to drinking, it becomes an addiction. And you'll do it even when, by your judgment, it's not good. Right? Now, by your judgment, it's not good. You're understanding, if I drink now, I'm at work. If I drink now, this. If I drink it. And all of a sudden, you have an addiction. Right? And this is who you are. You're your attention. Or, you may have an aversion. This was the attachment. This is a little different. Okay, no, it's not. Okay, but now understand this: that these samskaras can be this. You can have attachments for things that are healthy for you, that are good, that create a klishta samskaras. They create good things. You're altruistic. You know, your mother was very selfless, and then when you were young, they trained you to give in charity, and then you gave in charity, and now you like to give in charity, you like to help people. So you can have attachments for things that are bad, you can have attachments for things that are good, or you can have aversions. Now you grew up, right, and your father was a very honest man, right, and he said, don't lie. And you got an attraction for not lying. Or your father was a crook or a criminal and said to you, you know, you got to push your way to the top. And then you stole something, you got a little money for it, and then you're attracted to, you know, lying. Or you can be attracted to things that are good for you. You can be attracted for things that are bad for you. Right? You can be attracted to aklishta samskaras, good things. You can be attracted to bad things, klishta samskaras. You can be averse to good things. Think of itself. How many things that are good for you, but your mind says no? Even sometimes, like with exercise, right? I don't want to do it. Right? I don't want to do it. It's your samskaras. Right? And you can be averse to things that are bad for you, which is good. I will not do this. I will not tell a lie. I'm an honest person, even in difficult. So what you are, it says in yoga, is the impressions you have in your consciousness, your attractions and your attachments. And what they are, because a klishta samskara is either being attracted for the good things or being averse to the bad things, they mold the mind to goodness. And the klishta samskara is the attraction for the bad things and the aversion for the good things. They mold your mind to compassion and ignorance. So it says, this is what your mind is. Right? So therefore, when you get in a spiritual process and you hear good thoughts, what it's trying to do for you is create good samskaras for good things and averse to bad things. So when you build up, what happens is, now what's going to happen is this. Okay, I'm going to demonstrate it in a way, okay? And I hope you'll understand it this way. Okay, people can choose of their whatever they want. I've given beautiful varieties of stunning gray and blood red. Retta, you can help with that too. We'll hand them out and put one on your wrist. Okay? And I'll show you what this means. Now, at least for the next 2 days, it's understood, right, that the desire to criticize others is a klishta samskara. If you do it, your mind will be molded to a lower level of perception and contentment. Right? So now, hearing this and being trained in this, you understand you shouldn't do it. Now, if you have a strong understanding you shouldn't do something, so here is your real, you've done it so much. Right? It's huge. You can't stop yourself. And it's born not of the healthiest things in your heart, right? So what happens is, this is going to come up, because you do have these samskaras. Some more than others. So what happens is, when it comes up, right, the goal is, I'm going to show you, if you want to develop the habit of not criticizing, which will be an incredible morphing of the mind to a higher level of perception, I can guarantee it. If you can keep this on your wrist for 3 weeks without doing it, you will have a good habit to not criticize. So anytime you criticize, you have to switch the band and start all over. Okay? Now, what happens is something like this, right? I'll show you how it works. It's working for me because I have this habit. Especially being a comedian, it's at other people's expense. And until I started doing this, I never realized how much I do it. Right? It's unbelievable. I'll tell you, I took this vow. I'm doing a, I try to give of myself. I try to spend 1 month for myself, at least in a holy place alone, doing a lot of meditation. And at that time, you take a vow. It's a special month. So I take a vow for a lot of meditation in that month. And at the end of the month, the last 5 days, if you make a special vow, then you get even more benefit. So I saw my friend. I said, what vow are you going to do? He said, oh, I'm going to vow not to criticize others. I said, well, that's a good idea. I will also do. And we said, if we did criticize others, we do what Indians do when they say the wrong thing. You know what they do? They grab their ears, bite their tongue, and go like this. You don't have to do that. You couldn't believe how much I was like... how difficult it was being in a spiritual organization not to criticize. But anyway. So what happened was this. So this is what happens when you have this on there, just like this. So here is my habit, right? Every time I criticize, it just becomes. It's kind of like if you like the gossip, right? You like idle talk, and then Facebook comes out, and you go, wow, this will really lead to sublimity. I have faith that if I go online and chat, I'll have all the love I want. 2 years later, I'm going on a Facebook fast. You had faith in the wrong thing. It didn't help you. But what happens is, you go on the computer, right? You have a little like the thing, and you get this. Ah, that's nice. I like the chat. Then that's nice. I like the chat. I like the chat. I like this. And then what happens is, every moment you're near that computer, whether you're with your family, whether you're with friends, whether you have work, whether you have a paper due, whether you have a download, check my mail. I was going crazy. I'm giving classes and people, right? Addiction. You can't digest it. You can't say, no, I like to do this, but it's not right. Addiction. That's how the mind works. Now what happens is, if on the basis of an impulse, oh wow, here I should criticize, but I've now heard and got some good ideas and determination and took vows, and you have good samskaras for honesty, I will follow the truth, then what happens is, when that's about to come and make another impression for criticizing, you digest it. I feel like criticizing, you go to the intelligence, but it's not good to do so, I won't do it. Then what happens? It closes up. It doesn't create another one, it closes it. So it says, if you can resist for 3 weeks any habit, then what will happen is, those samskaras will close, but another samskara will do. Because when this comes and you don't do it, what happens is, by acting according to the appropriate thing in the mode of goodness, it morphs your mind to the mode of goodness, and you're actually happy by not doing it. So then you get another type of impression, something like, I like not criticizing. I like not criticizing. I like. And you completely change the impressions in your consciousness, because you actually get pleasure from doing the proper things. What I'm trying to do is extract from the Yoga Sutras the scientific, practical information. Even if our objective is not to go to the Himalayas and meditate, what the valuable things we can learn from these kind of teachings. Okay, so here it is. Anytime you feel like, you'll watch now how it works. You'll watch, oh my God, woo, I like to do this. And you know how you like to do it? Because you'll say, I want to do it so much. I want to criticize. I get fun from it. I get pleasure from it. But your intelligence says, this is not actually good for my consciousness. And I'm telling you, because I put it on again, because I gave this class in yoga psychology in Down Dog Yoga in Reading, Pennsylvania. And I taught it, so I put one on. And my God, I never realized how much samskaras I have for life. This is happens. You're about to do it, but by having this here, the end, there's the samskara, the thing that gave it pleasure, which is criticizing, is in front of you, that fool, and you're about to say something, but instead You go to the booty. You go to the intelligence. And if you do that, if you can do that for 3 weeks, what will happen is the pleasure you'll get from resisting an activity that molds your consciousness to a lower level of perception and contentment will create these samskaras in your consciousness that I like not criticizing. Okay, so yes, there's constructive criticism, but anyway, yeah.
Would there be a distinction between, let's say, for example, not criticizing versus instead deciding I'm going to compliment everyone or something like that, like taking more of a, like replacing it with an action? Or
okay, that's a very good, because in the Yoga Sutras, it when it describes these kleshas, these things that cause trouble for one, right, when it describes them, these things that cause trouble for one, what it describes is you can counteract them by opposing thoughts. So, for example, here's a classic one. Okay? We'll clean the mind again. Okay? You'll clean the mind again. Okay? Hate. Right? I'm in many circumstances where people have problems with one of their parents. Drives them absolutely crazy. Right? So they develop a kind of negativity or hate. Right? And every time they're in the process of that person, they just like, oh, right? Okay, but if they respond with hate, then it just increases. Right? So what happens is something like this. What the Yoga Sutras says, an opposing thought. So the opposing thought will be, you look at the good at the person, right? You somehow are in that mindset. You look in the good of the person, or you meditate on what this hate does to your consciousness. Right? I mean, if you're yogic and you're spiritual and you're hearing and you're thinking and you're on that process of self-improvement and you've got these kind of sciences that these books tell you, they're so powerful. When you get this type of science, and you actually start thinking like that, just like when I put this on again, it's so good for me. So now you say, not only that, you start to think, what will be the consequences of this? You know, to mold my mind and how I'll feel. So then you develop what it is, a whole other set of samskaras that are good, that are against the hate. Right? That's part of the Yoga Sutras. Basically, that verse in the Yoga Sutras is where all this comes from. It says, oppose negative thoughts, which is called klishta samskaras, klishta vrittis. Those bad thoughts, those degrading thoughts that are against the yamas and niyamas, the regulations and rules for proper behavior, if you counteract them. And then, this came from an organization called, although I made my own bands that say Jaya Radhe, because that's in my own tradition, but the bands were a complaint-free world. Because there was a Christian preacher, right, that he realized he's trying to give the message of Christ, and what's going on? Everyone's criticizing everyone. And they have those habits. And basically speaking, in one sense, it says criticism is worse than envy. Because envy is in the heart, criticism when it comes out. It says criticism is worse than throwing a spear through someone's body. Because the spear only pierces the body. Criticism pierces the heart. And that's why we're going to discuss ahimsa. That every other yam, niyam, and the whole thing is related to ahimsa. Because the whole yoga, whole spirituality is against selfishness. And the grossest selfishness is the hate and exploitation of others. Yeah.
What you're really talking about with this, it really makes sense, like, on the level of thought,
yeah,
as much as on the level of the spoken word, because I feel like we live in a culture where, like, we're kind of taught to smile, not express.
Yeah.
But if that thought, you know, if you resist being critical in
yeah.
your word, but you're still being critical in your mind, then doesn't that kind of cause, like, a deep resentment? Or couldn't it possibly cause a resentment? So...
Well, first of all, there's a way of talking about things without hate. It doesn't mean that you can't express yourself. It doesn't mean you can say something to others. Try it, and you'll see what are the thoughts behind the criticisms. And when you start looking at those, you'll see that actually they're not of any value. And what the fact of the matter is if you do express it in things, the hate only increases. So what's the benefit? So, yeah. But I understand, yeah, we don't want to be... And part of also in the Yoga Sutras, when it comes to the part of tapasya, you know, which is voluntary discomfort of the body and things like that as part of the necessity to become a yogi or something like that, it warns against excess. Because if you do things in excess, the mind becomes disturbed. Same things in terms with desires. There's neither, in a proper spiritual culture, there's not indulgence nor repression, because either one increases the thoughts away from the soul. So that's there. But when things are against, when the kleshas, when the yams and when the good habits and the good things and the thoughts come against them, if you want to elevate your consciousness, you have to deal with it. In other words, what yoga also in this philosophy told me is that we are creating ourselves. We have to be very careful what we're putting into our minds. Because what we are is there's something what we'll call Hita Pradesh says that our decisions determine our faith. In other words, it's what we do creates the future. What we are is that we've created it. So spiritual life is about creating a better future. So you have to have two things. You have to have knowledge and you have to have detachment. You don't have knowledge, you won't know what to do. If you don't have some kind of discipline, you can't do it. So we're identifying that this criticism based on hate, envy, it can be constructive. I'm just pointing this out as just an example. But try it and see. I like to see that someone came back to me tomorrow and said, you know, I didn't even have any negative thought. I didn't even know. And I'll tell you, I gave exercise, and once I gave this exercise, it was a psychological exercise, to meditate on someone that you harmed you or you don't like. And it was something with the law of karma. Release all the feelings and then put your own head on it. Take off that person's face, put your own head. It's a way to get rid of resentment from understanding the law of karma, that what's coming to you caused. That's another thing. But when I did that exercise, there was one person that could not think of anybody. And that person is just so nice. You know? So these are ideals. And this is why I think at Yoga Maya, these classes are here, yoga teachers, it's nice to learn the exercises, but actually evolve your consciousness. Because whatever you do, your consciousness is transformed. And if it's yoga, it should be a higher level of spiritual consciousness. And that will make you successful teachers. The more you can develop your own character, really. Yes.
Well, I was just ruminating, this is like two or three topics ago,
yeah,
where you're talking about the places and
yeah,
you went through the list of them. One of the things that I fear it might be unfair
yeah.
is that there's so many people that are born into a whole litany of these. I mean, they just don't have many alternatives.
Okay.
They might just simply have been raised in an environment where ignorance or fear is...
Yeah. Well, in what this philosophy would say, right, is what we didn't discuss karma. What happens is when you have klishta vrittis, bad thoughts based on exploitation, and you act on them, right, you get a reaction for them, right? And in the philosophy of reincarnation, it's just we're here since time immemorial. We have an incredible stock of reactions. I give other classes on karma, and I think it's pretty successful. Maybe this summer we should do one, Bryn. The psychology of karma, working with astrology. Maybe these people, after they finish their studies, we haven't done it in a while. It was the first one I did. And what that would mean is what happens is you create so many different reactions and only a certain amount can come in this life. So when you get take another life, then your karma comes with you. But if you understand the law of karma...
May I elaborate further on my question?
Yeah.
Part of this is me just thinking about current events and different things that are specific to this country. And I'm not really talking about an individual, just communities, different people that might be wrapped with a certain set of fears or ignorance. And how would you have an opportunity to intercede this, you know, potentially negative force without someone within their community that's enlightened, if any of that makes sense? Like, it just seems... to some degree, I wouldn't say, we are really, I'm thinking about this, we're thinking about this, but not everybody has that luxury. Maybe there's compassion, or I don't know how you break the force of these negative...
Well, there is things even called the Jivanmukta, that's someone who's liberated, but they stay... to actually influence others. I mean, all I can say is, I mean, this is just classic, is if you want to invoke change, you have to invoke change on yourself. I mean, there's one book called Seven Habits for Highly Effective People. He gives a very nice example. Around you, you have a circle of influence, and around that is a circle of concern. There's the things you want to change, and there's the things you can change. Things you can change are, one, yourself and those who you have relationships with, right? They say that if you just work on your circle of concern, trying to change everything before you change yourself, your influence reduces. And if you work on your circle of influence by working on the things that you can change in relationship to yourself, your influence becomes greater. So if we really have compassion, we really want to help people, we really have to work on ourselves and our influence. And it's a fact, we'll go to ahimsa. And it describes, ahimsa is the root of the, it's the first thing. If you want to control your mind, you have to control in relationship to others. If you can perfect ahimsa, they give the results of if you perfect. And ahimsa means, ahimsa just doesn't mean I'm a vegetarian. That's part of it. Ahimsa means when you get a certain level of nonviolence in your consciousness. The yams and niyams don't mean just one thing. It means a certain level for you. So when you become nonviolent to a certain, when you actually can perfect that, it says the fruit of that is that those in your proximity cannot be aggressive. It says in someone who's perfected ahimsa, even a mongoose and a cobra cannot fight in their presence. And in spiritual traditions, there's always an exemplar. In Catholicism, there's Saint Francis. In our tradition, there's Chaitanya. When you really... And that really requires, honestly speaking, a pure heart. There's no selfishness in you, because it's described, if there's any selfishness to that extent, you can't be nonviolent, because you're going to exploit to some degree or another. See?
Like, I mean, I think it's always important, because you started the whole talk off, first of all, pointing out, like, what the Yoga Sutra, like who are these teachings really originally, like, who's really studying them? And
yeah.
Secondly, just the very first sutra, to talk about the implication of now. And so in many ways, we have to sort of see the sutra for where really, like the sutras for what they are, which is that the it's a higher level of study and understanding. So even though, like, it's talking about everybody, that it means, like, the human mind operates this way, I think, like, when we have that sort of, that, you know, because it comes up in other ways also in the sutras, at least for me, where when you have that moment where it feels like how this, you know, how everybody can't be in the right place to do this, you know, I think we have to remind ourselves that actually that's why it's considered, you know, when Professor Ryan was here, you know, one of the things that he reiterates over and over is that in India, you know, only scholars study the Yoga Sutras. Like, is that even a regular person who even is interested in yoga doesn't even study the sutra? You know, so it's such a elevated text, right? I mean, it's such a scholarly text.
It is.
It has a practical application, but on the other hand, we have to keep it in perspective, right?
Right.
That we're not saying that this is this is where it begins. Like, I think it sort of says you have to be at a certain place before you can really digest this, right? So therefore, in that environment that you're talking about, I think it starts with something else. It starts before this comes into play, and maybe that's wrong.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah, it's fact that. Reading it, I'm trying, that's why I'm saying I wasn't just going to, my plan was, you know, at a particular time, like, you know, just go through the verses now and cover one verse after another. I wanted to keep your attention. Second of all, I wanted to speak things that are absolutely relevant. I wanted to show myself how there's relevance in it. But it's a fact that it was for yogis. But I think the beauty of the text is that by understanding the mind, it has a very practical relevance to ourselves, especially if you are yogis, to a certain extent. And I have a sense a lot of times that people that come to these trainings, there's some yearning for something a little bit, you know, a little change of consciousness in their lives and things like that, but the other thing is, there's always ideals, you know. And in my tradition, this is the ideal, this is where you are, right? Okay, now should you feel guilty? Well, if you grew up with our mothers, yes, but that's just a joke. Okay. But should you feel guilty? No, but there's humility. And the difference between guilt and humility is guilt is really, if you have knowledge and you understand an ideal, right, and you're not doing anything about it. Humility is, this is the standard, this is where I am, how do I move towards it? That's humble. You don't have to feel guilty if you're moving towards some higher ideal. You know, you don't have to feel guilty, I'm not at the ideal. You know, I'm not here. Okay, just to end, let's just go through a few verses now. I thought that we have a kind of a basis of the relevance here. We'll go to the next verse, and then we're going to go. And I just said, the next 3 hours, for those of you that are still here, I know I still have to go, but the next 3 hours, I'm kind of excited also to deal with the recommendations for meditation. Practical meditation. Anyway, we'll see. Okay, here we go. Okay, that was 2. Now 3 says, I think when you have a frame of reference like this, then it makes sense just to go through the text a bit, okay? Why don't I can't find three? What page?
22.
22. Okay. Tada drashtu srupe vastitam. When that is accomplished, the seer abides in its own true nature. Okay, that's very simple, right? Here's the soul. Here's the mind and the body. When this is accomplished, when thoughts are quelled, the mind becomes completely reflective and you're able to live within yourself, which is a sense of eternity and happiness. Okay, so that's yoga. When that is accomplished, and therefore Patanjali is also assuring the audience that when you eliminate thought, it does not mean the elimination of existence itself. Because there are schools of philosophy that when you eliminate thought, you eliminate the soul no longer exists. But what's saying here, no, when you give up you control the thoughts and you quell the thoughts, then actually it's not that you become non-existent, no. You begin to dwell in your own nature. And the seer means, it's one of the names for soul. You should understand this in that Sanskrit. The soul is called Purusha. The soul is called Atman. It's also called Drashtu. Drashtu is the seer. Okay? And the example, the practical example that is given is an example of a crystal. A crystal ball may reflect a red color. The red is really external to the crystal ball. But when you remove the red, it doesn't mean that the crystal ball is gone. So these are the classical examples. And that's also an example how somehow or other our self, our pure self, our eternal self, somehow or other has a tendency to reflect that which is in its proximity and identify itself as one with that. You know, even these thoughts, you know, because I'm talking about practicality, to actually somehow or other, and this is what even mindfulness is, you know, not just to become absorbed in all the thoughts and conceptions and ideas, and to understand that they're a bit external and just observe them. So, very important. Elimination of experience, elimination of thoughts does not mean the elimination of existence. There are some schools that believe this. And that's the difference between yoga and Buddhism, actually speaking. The meditation is the same, but the conception is different. It's not that the self is based on the thoughts. That the self is, in yoga, the self is not based, it is not based on having an object. And again, this is not so relevant to speak here, but there's a lot that can be said of the different schools of thought and how they, yeah, actually here. It says three possibilities may transpire when all the vrittis, the states of mind, have been removed. Does the soul remain as pure consciousness that is conscious of only itself? Does it remain unconscious like a log of wood, being conscious only when confronted by the state of mind? And it says, does it cease to exist like a lamp on the destruction of the wick? So there's different conceptions. Yoga means the first one. When the thoughts are gone, it doesn't mean existence is gone. Then 4 says, vritti sarupam itarata. Otherwise, at other times, the seer is absorbed in the changing states of the mind. So, at other times, when the thoughts are not quelled, then you become absorbed in those transformations as it is yourself. An example would be that a lady who wants to be a model is working on her figure, and she wants to be very, very thin. And somehow or other, she goes into a house of mirrors, and the mirror is, convex. And she sees this huge figure, and she becomes in complete anxiety. At other times, when you're not actually reflected on your true self, but see, if the mirror is proper, you'll be reflected on your pure, your true self. If the mirror is convex, you'll see something else, and therefore you'll, and this is the basis of all suffering. Okay, I'm conscious that we have to end at 4, but I cannot resist my devotional impulses that we should end with some kirtan meditation. But I'm actually going to show you, according to the Yoga Sutras, how to meditate. But not right now, we'll just meditate on kirtan. Any pair of phone calls, then you'll try. Okay? And then we take a break, right? Okay, sit up. Meditation means just the mantra in the mind. You let all other thoughts go. And we'll just, I'll chant one full mantra and then you'll respond. I just want to make sure my watch is the right time because I want to be responsible here. What?
I think we have 5 minutes.
What's that?
We have 5 minutes.
We have 5 minutes, okay. Just take just a few deep breaths. Just relax. Feel the cool air going in and the hot air going out. Relax your shoulders. You just hear the mantra, and the perfection of mantra is if you can hear every syllable of the mantra, you'll get the fruit of the mantra. This is a Yugala of Bhakti mantra. It will bring devotion in your heart. When you hear the mantra, just feel the mantra. And then after you hear the mantra, then you can respond. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Krishna, Krishna, Hare Krishna.